This is a Crowd podcast.
I want to play something for you. Something that when I recorded it, shook me to my core.
There's no danger. There's no racking. There's nobody with a weapon. There's no military-aged male.
Well, then...
Who opens fire, and how the fuck does anybody think it's okay to open fire in that room?
In that scenario, it's not. Yeah. In that scenario, it's not okay.
By the time I had this conversation with Frank, I'd been filming him for years. We discussed his case, and specifically what happened in House 2, at least a dozen times. Maybe more. In fact, the very day I recorded this interview, Frank had been arraigned, formally charged with murder in House 2. And yet, he still could not remember what happened in that home. It was infuriating.
How does a family in a back room with the door closed, only women and children?
Is that what it was?
Yeah, Frank. There wasn't anything in there.
That night, I pressed Frank one last time. What he said so shocked me, I haven't played the tape for anyone until now.
I did not know there was only women and children in that room.
Today?
Correct.
If I may, how can you not know that? That's the hard fact of the case.
No one's ever said that.
That in House 2, in the back room, there are only women and children?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard that. Ever.
My name is Michael Epstein, and you're listening to my podcast about the longest, most expensive criminal investigation in U.S. military history. Murder in House 2. Episode 7. The Enigma of Frank Wooderich.
I'm going to ask you a slightly personal question, but how do you get mad? You know, which is...
It seems like I never do.
Yeah.
Have you ever spent time, quality time, with a mass murderer? I grant you, it's not a question you get asked every day, but still, have you? Because for a good long time, I found myself asking that exact question.
I think if somebody didn't know you, Frank, they might say that you have no emotion. Just that you don't care, you're detached.
Yeah, I think I deal with things sort of unusually. Probably not how typical people deal with things. Sometimes I tend to think about things just very logically and without emotion. I mean, it's true. I do. Like I said, I don't know how I learned that or where I learned it, but it's just, I don't know.
Frank had been charged with 18 counts of murder. The government, in effect, said Frank was a mass murderer. If convicted, he could have gone to jail for a very long time, possibly the rest of his life. The pressure must have been immense. But here's the thing. I had no idea if it was. I couldn't tell you if Frank felt stress or anxiety, if he felt guilt or was overwhelmed with remorse, or if he was angry or sad or anything. Because I never saw any emotion from Frank Wooderich.
Is it that you're not showing emotion? That there is emotion?
Oftentimes it is.
But they're there?
Yeah, they're there. They're there. I'm just in a position now to where, you know, I feel like I need to show the least amount of emotion as possible. As far as for perception reasons or whatever the case may be. I just choose not to do that in front of other people.
I want to read you something. Something I thought about every time I was with Frank. It's the very first paragraph from a book called The Journalist and the Murderer by Janet Malcolm. Here's what it says. Every journalist who is not too stupid or full of himself to notice what's going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible. He's a kind of confidence man, preying on other people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse. Journalists justify their treachery in various ways, according to their temperaments. The more pompous talk about freedom of speech and the public's right to know. The least talented talk about art. The seemliest murmur about making a living. Ouch. Not the most flattering portrait of journalism, but I think more accurate than most want to admit. Janet Malcolm was writing about Joe McGinnis and a book he wrote called Fatal Vision. In it, McGinnis told the story of Jeffrey McDonald, who had been accused of a horrible crime, the murder of his 26-year-old pregnant wife and his two young daughters. It was a sensational story, fodder for the day's tabloids. And in the middle of that scandal, McGinnis achieved something of a journalistic coup: unfettered access to McDonald and his defense team. Joe McGinnis lived with Jeffrey McDonald. He exercised with him, sat at his defense table in the courtroom, all with the understanding that when McDonald's trial was over, McGinnis would write a book about it. McDonald ended up being found guilty of murder, and he hated McGinnis's book, which savaged him when it came out. Jeffrey McDonald was convinced Joe McGinnis had betrayed him. I think you can see why I kept thinking about the journalist and the murderer every time I was with Frank. See, for a documentary, or in this case, a podcast, to be any good, for it to have any drama, you not only have to gain the trust of your subject, you have to find a way to film them in what is almost certainly the very worst moment of their life. Who does that? Who willingly invades someone's most private moments and then puts them on display for a living? And I'm not asking that question casually or rhetorically. At some point in my journey, even as I was putting together this podcast, I started to wonder, what am I doing? Is Frank fully aware that whatever I create from all this footage might make him look bad? That he might end up being portrayed as the killer he so emphatically claims he's not? And what about my independence? I filmed Frank and his family for years. 6.5, to be exact. That's an awful lot of time to spend with someone and not feel anything, good or bad. And as any honest journalist or documentary filmmaker will tell you, if you grow to like your subject, it colors how you depict them. It has to. And not just how you tell your story, but what story you even tell. But what if you grow to dislike or distrust your subject? What if you've come to think they're lying, that they really are guilty? Are you obligated to tell them what you think, how you feel, even if it means it'll jeopardize your access? I say all this because, as I told you, I came to like Frank. In fact, the more I got to know him, the more impossible it seemed to me that he could gun down a room full of women and children and then lie about it. Then again, maybe I was too concerned about maintaining my access to accept the truth.
So is it strange being back home?
Yeah, I haven't been home in since 2008. And I don't come back here very often, but I always love coming back home.
A few months before Frank's court-martial, Frank made a trip home to visit his parents in Connecticut. Remarkably, at that point, I knew next to nothing about his childhood.
What I really like, I think, about Connecticut is just kind of the small town feel and the trees. Like, there's a lot of forest and woods, and I used to love, you know, playing in the woods and whatnot. My parents didn't like it so much, but, you know, me and my friend Will used to have a fort that we built in the woods that no one knew about except us, and, you know, it was a lot of fun. And so
when Frank told me he was coming out east for a visit, I grabbed my camera and drove up to Connecticut to meet him.
So right up here is where I used to go to church every single Sunday. Did Sunday school, and then as I got older was an altar boy and did that whole bit. I was in their Christmas pageants every year.
everything, baptized, confirmed, first communion.
No, I don't think I've ever asked you, but do you feel like you're a religious person at all? When you did all that?
Maybe I'd rather not say. No, I have, I'm very much a science person, I think. And so, I never, going to church, you know, I would do the work and pass the test and all that to be able to get, you know, confirmed and all that. But I just, things just didn't really click for me there. I didn't really understand at all. And so I think, you know, I kind of feel the same way now. So this used to be a diner where my mom used to go, I think, like every morning and get her coffee and hang out there for a couple hours. Oh, okay, here we go. McDonald's, first job. Worked there for 4 months. It was like 4 years to me. It was miserable. And, you know, my elementary school is right on the other side of this red house. My mom would pick me up when I was in kindergarten and we'd go over to McDonald's and I'd sit in a high chair and drink milk and her girlfriend would, you know, chit chat and all that stuff. Then I'd go home and have pea soup for lunch. But there we go. Benjamin Franklin.
It's funny how we remember very specific things.
Yes. It was a condensed version and I hated it. That's probably why. I mean, I think it would make me gag every time I ate it.
McDonald's and pea soup. Makes you wonder why we remember certain things, even 20, 30 years on, and yet can forget something that just happened. Like whether you murdered an entire family in their home. But that was the enigma of Frank Wooderich. He could remember pea soup from when he was 5, but not what happened in House 2. And I guess at some point, I had to decide whether or not to believe Frank. To decide whether or not he was the kind of person who could stand at the foot of a bed, shoot a bunch of women and children, and then forget or lie about it. In other words, was Frank one kind of person at home and an entirely different person in war?
Okay, this is Lincoln Middle School here. My first real kiss was in Lincoln Middle School in the hallway in 7th grade.
With who?
Heather Carpini was her name. She's married now, I think, has kids. But, yep. Yep. It's funny. I think I remember every single one of my girlfriend's first and last names. Starting from kindergarten.
Kindergarten. Girlfriends in kindergarten?
Yeah, I got in trouble for kissing girls in kindergarten, actually. They sent a note home and called my parents because I was kissing girls on the playground and stuff.
As I shot this, I remember thinking, what the hell is going on? Everything seems so normal, so all-American. Altar boy at church. A secret fort in the woods, working at the local McDonald's, kissing Heather Carpini in the school hallway. There was nothing in Frank's past that suggested any trauma, anything that would make him hide his emotions or keep him from remembering essential details he needed to remember for his own defense. But then we went looking for the spot in the woods where Frank and his best friend built their fort when they were kids. And out of nowhere, Frank opened up.
You spent some of your childhood here?
Yeah, I spent 15 years here. I was adopted when I was 3, and so lived in Meriden since then until 18. So, yep, spent 15 years.
You're adopted?
Yes.
So when you were 3, though, so you were in foster care for a little bit?
Yeah, I went from... Yep. From living with my, you know, biological mom and that sort of thing. And then went through, I think, 2 different foster families. And then eventually my mom and dad adopted me and my sister. So, yeah, kind of cool.
Do you know your biological mother at all? Or?
I've never met her. No, I don't. I've seen pictures of her. But yeah, that's it. It was a closed adoption, I think, so. At the time, that's what they did. So,
Any desire to know your biological mother? Or how old were you when you...
Me and my sister were assigned a social worker, I guess, when we were about to be adopted. And I was 3. My sister was 4 when we were adopted. So we would visit, you know, my mom and dad for a short time. And then we'd go back. And then we'd do that 2 or 3 times. And eventually we just... social worker just kind of said, all right, well, you know, here you go. And here's your new home and mom and dad. And, you know, we had already met them, you know, several times before that and whatnot. And so that was that, yeah, 3 years ago.
How old were you when your mom gave you up for adoption?
The story, as I know it, is that the state made her give us up. For whatever reason, not sure why. You know, I vaguely remember, I guess, the time that it happened. You know, my biological mom had, you know, kind of told me and my sister, hey, you know, we're going out to the store. And, you know, she knew at the time what was about to happen. And then from that point, I never, you know, saw her again. So, and, you know, whoever came and took us, and we lived in a couple of foster homes, and eventually got adopted. My parents picked us out of a book, a lineup, I suppose, and you know, that's how that happened.
You following all this? Frank and his sister were taken from their biological mother by the state. His mother never said goodbye. Instead, she told Frank, who was 3 at the time, she was going to the store and simply never came back. Frank and his sister were put into several foster care homes before being adopted by his parents.
Yeah, I don't really care about it or think about it. It crosses my mind, oh man, you know, once every several years, but it's certainly not something that I think about or dwell about. I mean, my mom and dad are my mom and dad, and that's just how it was and is. I don't know the story. I was way too young, obviously. And, you know, for whatever reason, it happened that way. So I do have another younger, I think, half-brother somewhere out there that I was told about, but obviously never met or don't know much about that, so.
And the final revelation. Frank had a brother who was only an infant when the state took him and Frank from their mother. A brother who Frank never saw again.
From what I understand, he was like just born or you know, very, very young. And so the social worker in the state, whoever, you know, does the procedures for adoption, didn't feel like it was necessary for him at such a young age to remain with us.
So is there residual anger?
No, I don't have any anger or resentment. I just really don't think about it. I mean, if I thought about it, there would just be too many questions that would never be answered. It's not worth dwelling over thinking about. So.
It's not worth dwelling over. Not worth thinking about. If I thought about it, there would just be too many questions that would never be answered. I gotta give Frank this. He is consistent. Now, I'm no more a psychiatrist or a therapist than I am a Marine, and there's a real danger in inferring too much from Frank's story. But ask yourself this. Does knowing about Frank's childhood change how you feel about him? About what you think he's capable of doing? Does it change how you feel about the case? Because if I'm completely honest with you, it did for me. I mean, is this the backstory of a mass murderer?
This is Michael, and I don't know about you, but sometimes life gets so busy I don't have the time to cook, but I still want delicious, healthy, gourmet meals. Enter Factor. Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals are always fresh and never frozen. Each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat the flexitarian and protein-rich meals, and with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. Last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon, and it was quick and amazing. And if you want more than meals, there are over 60 add-ons, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies to help you stay fueled and feel good all day. And if you're like me and you're always looking for gourmet options, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. You can always pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. So what are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/murderhouse50 and use code murderhouse50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's murderhouse50 at factormeals.com/murderhouse50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
AM, the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3AM, the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.
One cold December afternoon, Neil Puckett, Frank's lawyer, called me with some bad news. Frank and his wife Marisol were separating. Neil didn't know all the details, but he was worried about Frank's emotional state. And he asked if I would fly out to Camp Pendleton to help him check in on Frank and his family.
Does Maddie seem more stressed than she used to be? I mean, is she like quicker to anger or less patient? No,
she seems to be the same, you know, woman that I've always known. But, you know, right now, we're kind of going through some issues. So
really?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, that's, I guess, for us to work out. We haven't really talked a whole lot about it more lately, but she last night said that she is probably going to go away for like a month or something, you know.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about that, Frank.
It's a lot of things. I don't know. I'm not going to get into it really. The one thing that I didn't want to get out of, you know, I guess telling you guys was this whole feeling that you have that this is because of the case. You know, it goes a lot, you know.
Deeper
and further than that, you know.
Are you thinking that you guys are going to end up splitting ultimately after separating? I mean, is that a possibility?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
You've considered that as a possibility?
The next day, I went and talked to Frank's wife, Marisol.
So, I filed for divorce last week. He's being served today. Words were exchanged. I said some pretty hurtful things. I said maybe what they were saying about him was right. Maybe he wouldn't have, like, think twice about doing what he did in Iraq. And then I called back and I apologized for saying that. But I was, like, so mad at him. So I regret bringing that into it, yeah. But he honestly is not, like, the same person I used to know. Like, really, he's just changed so much.
1 week before Christmas, Marisol and the girls moved out of the family home, leaving Frank all alone. 2 weeks later, Frank was formally arraigned, meaning he was charged in a court of law for the civilian deaths in Haditha.
It's the beginning of the end, so...
How does that feel?
I'm part scared, but hopeful. If that makes sense. I don't know. Either way, it's going to be over pretty shortly.
That night, as I told you at the beginning of this episode, I went to Frank's now empty home and talked to him about his divorce, the upcoming court-martial, and why he still couldn't remember what happened in House 2.
I think there was a time when Neil said that you were prepared to serve time, maybe when it was further away.
When everything first kind of came about, and, you know, like right when we got back and, you know, everything kind of just exploded and blew up, it was then that I probably felt the worst as far as mentally and all that. As time has gone on, I've gotten more confident with how certain things are playing out. Obviously, you know, there's still a lot of questionable things, but yeah, I mean, there was definitely a time where, I mean, I didn't know. I mean, shit, it was a time when there was a possibility that I'd be sentenced to death, you know?
How'd you cope with that?
It's a good question. I try not to think about it as much as possible. and that seems to be my answer for a lot of things, but it was rough. I mean, you know, I'm not gonna lie. I mean, I don't know how I coped with it.
What impact do you think it had on your personal life?
Marisol noticed that maybe I started, like, drinking more, and there were several times where, you know, I'd either, like, cry to her or talk to her about stuff. And I mean, she was always understanding, you know. But I just remember, you know, like, I don't know, she continued to put up with the shit that I put her through.
Well, you know, Monty would say to me periodically, and I'm sure you know, I stood by him. There was a sense of anger, and I think a sense from her that what you went through was pretty traumatic. Mm-hmm. Court-martial, publicity stuff aside.
Right.
And that you didn't get the proper counseling, and that you came back broken in her mind, and that the marriage suffered. She stood by you through what she thought was a dark time. And
I don't think it was Iraq that broke me, I guess, as she put it, or, you know, made me different. I think it's really just this whole investigation circus going on. I mean, that's the stress that's in my life, is the investigation. It's not, you know, me trying to deal with things that happened in Iraq or things that I saw. It isn't. It's just, it's really just the investigation. I'm angry at myself for not being able to defend myself, because I don't remember. Everything is just so jumbled up that I cannot remember what happened, and therefore I can't even defend myself if I don't know what the fuck happened.
Frank wasn't the only one frustrated by his inability to remember. We all were. I mean, how do you defend a guy whose only defense is, I forgot? And so, with the trial only weeks away and his family in ruins, Frank's legal team, Neil, Haytham, and Colby, made one last-ditch attempt to jog Frank's memory by sending him and me to Haditha.
Hey guys, can we just stop doing everything for one second?
We gotta move, man.
I know, but we've got
like 15 minutes and we've gotta be gone.
I know, but Frank is going through the thing.
Hey, we gotta move.
Okay.
We don't have much time left.
Okay.
What are you thinking, Frank?
I'm trying to remember what happened.
In the next episode, Frank finally tells us what happened in House 2.
He's trying to sugarcoat it, Stashart. I don't even know what happened. Okay? So let's cut the bullshit. You sat in my office one day and you said you didn't shoot in the back bedroom.
Yes, sir.
Okay? I know you know what happened. Whatever the reason, I don't give a shit. You want to keep it to yourself? You shoot yourself. You're going down. Everybody's turned on you. Nobody gives a shit about you.
If you want more murder in House 2, join us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where we'll be posting videos of what you've just heard, as well as photographs and copies of original investigative documents. Just search for Murder in House 2. This is a Crowd Network podcast in association with Buccaneer Media and the Dakota Group. The podcast was produced by Steve Jones and edited by Ed Eniot, with additional editing by Ed Barteski Jr. and R.A. Fetty. Executive producers for Crowd Network are Mike Carr and Mike Pearls, and for Buccaneer Media, Tony Wood and Richard Tulk Hart. Original music by Joel Goodman, with additional tracks from BMG Production Music. Finally, if you'd like another podcast recommendation, check out a Crowd Network original called The Mentor, where businessman Rick Lewis tries to change the lives of three young people in just 12 weeks. 2020 has been a crappy year for most of us, but Rick and The Mentor podcast are at least trying to end it with some good news. Give it a listen. Just search for The Mentor in your podcasting app. I'm Michael Epstein. Thanks for listening.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done. And that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.
Creeping in, don't
introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
That was all fictitious.
She stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
Hi, this is Amy and Vanessa from She Goes By Jane, where we shine light on the stories of missing and unidentified women. On November 7th, we're sharing Nahida's story for the first time in a podcast. And this is a story that I thought I knew, but after reading police reports, became more complicated than I thought. When investigators are called to Nahida Khatib's house, everything looks fine. Her purse is on the kitchen table, her cup of coffee is on the counter, and her two-year-old niece is in her playpen. The only thing amiss? Nahida is missing.
Every week, we feature a poem written in honor of the person we're talking about. This week, we're joined by one of our favorite actresses. You might know her from Sister Act or King of the Hill or The Descendants. But if you're like us, you'll know her from Hocus Pocus. She's the much-beloved Kathy Najimy. Join us November 7th to hear Nahida's story.